When it comes to baseball, there are iconic family names associated with the sport: Steinbrenner, O'Malley, Bush, and of course, the name Vec. The Vec family has been in baseball for a century, dating back to when William Vec Sr. was the president of the Chicago Cubs. And during his years with the Cubs, Vec Sr. gained fame as the person who first decided to grow ivy on the outfield walls at Wrigley Field. And then Mike's father, Bill Vec, went on to become the owner of the St. Louis Browns, Cleveland Indians, and also Chicago White Sox, and then the minor league Milwaukee Brewers at that time. His father is probably best remembered for signing Larry Doby, the first black player in the American League. Also, he was the owner that sent a 3-foot-6-inch Eddie Goodell to the plate for the Browns in a 1943 game against the Detroit Tigers. Bill Vec is inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, and his son Mike started his baseball career in the mid-70s, working for his father as an assistant business manager and director of marketing for the Chicago White Sox, and he's still very, very much involved with baseball. At the minor league level, he is the president and owner of the Charleston River Dogs in Charleston, South Carolina, and also part owner of 5 or 6 other minor league teams. And he joins us on Sports Byline. Mike, good to have you back here on Sports Byline. This is an anniversary. You were involved with the White Sox with your father when they put on the Disco Demolition. Tell me a little bit about how that promotion came about.
Well, you know, it's great to be back with you, Ron, and that one especially was notable because it actually had its genesis in 1977. We did a disco dancing contest in Chicago and actually involved 25 or 30 of the great dance halls, saloons, slash clubs, call them what you will. And at the end of the night, we repaired to Miller's Pub, and we had a couple of beverages. And at 4:30 in the morning, Jeff Schwartz and I were laughing about what a funny idea it would be to have a night for people who hated disco, and honoring rock and roll. So we called it Anti-Disco Night, went to sleep, and never thought about it again for 2 years until we had a twi-night doubleheader with the Detroit Tigers, a makeup game. And I happened to tune in to WLUP, a 5,000-watt station in Chicago, up against LS and CFL, and I heard Steve Dahl blow up a disco record. I called him at 10:05, said, "You ever done that live?" Said, "Only the shopping center." I said, "Well, get practice and we got a ballpark to fill." Never thinking, of course, that it would.
What was the object? What were you trying to do aside from what you just stated that you wanted to do with disco? I mean, at the end of a promotion, there is usually something you're trying to accomplish. What was that?
Well, in this case, we were symbolically trying to end what we felt collectively was a blight on the American music scene. I'd spent several years on the road playing music before I joined the White Sox, and it was very much tongue-in-cheek, but it literally gave the other side a voice. And what we were really trying to do, as you better than anybody know, Ron, is we were trying to put people in the stands, because the 79 White Sox themselves were not an overly exciting bunch. And so when you have a makeup game on the calendar, it became a twi-night doubleheader. I looked out my window, told the cops in Chicago we'd be lucky if we had 35,000, but I was betting we'd have 35,000. Well, we had 35,000 lined up outside the old Comiskey Park at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We opened the gates at 4. It was a twi-night doubleheader, first pitch at 5 o'clock. At 6 o'clock, we sealed the gates with 60,000 people inside. By 7 o'clock, there were 40,000 people outside trying to get in. So at the end of the night, we had 100,000 people. Of course, the baseball gods weren't kind. We forfeited the second game after losing the first one 3-1, and the rest is history. That was only the fourth forfeiture in the history of baseball, and it made it very difficult for me to find a job after leaving the White Sox.
Tell everybody, Mike, about how it came off and what actually happened that caused the forfeiture in that second game.
Well, as I'm standing there, you know, we had a stick of dynamite. The Cardellano family, who'd been very instrumental in helping Dad design and build the exploding scoreboard, we were all friendly. So everybody brought a disco album. They got in for 98 cents, and we collected the disco albums. And between games, we put them in a dumpster, rolled it out to the center field warning track, put a stick of dynamite in and blew them up 250 feet in the air. And it's still, as I'm telling you this, 3 years later, the most exciting explosion I've ever seen. At the very top, 250 feet in the air, was my career. I'm standing at second base, marveling at this thing, thinking, boy, we're going to make the cover of Rolling Stone, and all of a sudden, we were going to make it all right, but not in the way I had in mind. Four people slid down the foul poles. 10 guys jumped from the center field bleachers, which at Old Comiskey was a pretty good drop. And in 4.5 minutes, there were 10,000 kids on the field, which I attributed to the fact that it was only 10 years after Woodstock. So it was a celebration of sorts. And the next day, Bowie Kuhn, or that's Bowie of Kuhn, I think he was Landon Gentry, said no more negative promotions in baseball.
What was your dad's reaction to all of this, Mike?
He was the only one who was really sane about it. I mean, you know, Jimmy Pearsall built another year and a half career on yelling from the press box, and Bill Gleason, the old great writer for the Sun-Times, chastised me roundly. But at 2 o'clock in the morning, the old man looked at me and he said, you know, McGill, he always called me McGillicuddy for Connie Mack, his one hero. He said, every once in a while, a promotion works too well. And that was his signal to me that while he was unhappy with the results, he understood that when you bob a lightning, it happens so rarely, and it's very hard to predict where it's going to end up. And in this case, it ended up on my resume.
Yeah, I remember the story, and maybe you saw this episode of WKRP Cincinnati when the station put on this promotion where they were over a ball game and they wanted to let people have let people have money, and they tied it to turkeys and threw them out of a helicopter. Well, the problem is that turkeys don't fly, and they all crashed into the
thing. Yes, I've actually over the years heard something about that. But you know what's so strange, Ron? And you know, I don't know how many, some 15,000, 12,000, however many shows you've done, which is just a real credit to you. But over that time, one of the things that I remember laughing about this promotion was the first 10 or 15 years I was a pariah. I mean, I couldn't get a job except in radio and soccer, which, of course, soccer fans love riots. So, but, you know, now it's become kind of warm and fuzzy and part of the, you were there then. And it's really been a strange shift, almost 180 degrees.
Yeah, I think in this day and age, people are looking for people that think outside the box. I think, Mike, you were just ahead of your time an awful lot. Before we break here, and we've got about 2 minutes, tell me a little bit about what your dad's philosophy was that you then gleamed onto about promotion when it came to sporting events.
You got to take a chance. You got to take a chance, and you have to do everything that you can to involve the fans and listen to the fans. And because he is, as you so kindly put it, an iconic figure, people forget that legends get that way because they have lots of failures. So when Dad buried the 1948 pennant in Cleveland that he won, the World Championship in 1949, they fricasseed him for 3 days for the tasteless gesture of burying the flag. So, you know, it depends time, place, and tongue, how far it's in cheek.
You know, Charlie Finley was another kind of maverick. Did your dad see himself as a maverick? And I would assume that during that period of time that everybody else was not like Mr. Vec.
Yeah, he the great thing about Charlie tailored himself, or Charles O, as we refer to him lovingly, he really tailored himself as a maverick, not necessarily after Dad. I think that sells him short. But Dad never really set out. Dad loved to annoy the establishment, and that was really much more his goal. He understood that the fans are the single most important element of any sporting event, and so he wanted to entertain them, and he knew that they, like himself, were mistrustful of pomposity and large amounts of money and guys who bought ball clubs as toys. So that really gave him much more motivation than to create a name for himself.
We only have 30 seconds left, but Mike, I'm sure your dad realized he could do nothing about how many W's and how many L's the team had, but he could do something about the experience that the fan had. Am I correct in that assumption?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and he'd take it a step further and say, look, every game is not going to be the most exciting. You know, your Warriors aren't always going to perform. And so there's nothing wrong with sending people home with the idea that win or lose, boy, we had a great time. And that doesn't mean he wasn't competitive. It simply means that he was realistic.
We're talking with Mike Vec. He is the president and owner of the Charleston River Dogs, a couple of other minor league teams as well. And certainly that Vec name is iconic when it comes to sports and particularly to baseball. And when we come back on the other side, I'm going to talk to Mike about some of the promotions he's done at the minor league level, about the minor league baseball experience and how it differs from the major league experience and where he thinks experiences in sports are going. We've got you on America's Sports Talk Show.